Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. It is Friday the 13th, 2019, the last Friday the 13th for a while, I think. And a great day to go over some of the best and worst products of this very strange and very uncomfortably long year. This has been a long and winding road, but I'm very glad to have Jerry Hildenbrand back on the show to help me through it. How's it going?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And back by popular demand, Martin Barsa of Tech Altar. I like to say Tech Altar, but you call yourself Tech Altar, which I really love.
Well, you're the native speaker, so you're probably right. thanks for having me.
I think you are, for a non-native English speaker, you are one of the most eloquent English speakers I've ever heard on YouTube.
Well, thank you.
So I just think perhaps the English education in Germany is better than the English education in North America, perhaps? Or you just take it more seriously than we do. Either way, well done.
Thank you.
So we're going to spend today's show going over the best of 2019. And that is no small feat. There's a lot of stuff that happened in 2019. And obviously, it's not going to be an exhaustive list. In fact, it's only going to be a few things. But we're going to do sort of a round table discussion, starting with the biggest story of the year, I think is something each of us have our own thoughts on. And then the best product of the year, and then the biggest disappointment of the year. So that's the stage setting for now. And I think we'll just dive right in. So the biggest story of the year is one that I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts on, Martin, because, you know, this was a year of iteration in many ways, but there on the margins, you can see revolution happening. It's coming. We're not quite there yet. So we're sort of at that, you know, at the most mature point of the smartphone ecosystem. Android is mature, iOS is mature, every ecosystem, every platform is getting mature, and we're eking out as much goodness from that maturity as possible. But your story of the year is quite huge, and I'd love you to explain it, what it is.
Yeah, so my story of the year is that I think this year we saw hardware beat software. So for a long time, we've seen software companies trying to get into hardware and hardware companies trying to get into software. I think the best example of that would be Google trying to get into making Pixels. And I think there has been an assumption for many years that because Google is so good at software, at AI, at camera processing algorithms and all this stuff, that they would just start making phones and then become the champion of everything. And we've actually seen that year after year, they've had trouble making really good hardware, and that flashy hardware and big specs and beautiful designs in the end tend to perform better than even the best software on the market. So we see companies like Realme, for example, who've become hugely popular with very good hardware at very good prices, or even Huawei, who, despite having all their software issues, continues to do incredibly well, or Samsung, who, despite all of the immaturity of the software on the Galaxy Fold, managed to sell a million devices. So I think my story of the year is that hardware was the key driver in business success in tech this year.
So my first question to you then is it because the hardware was so much better than in previous years, or because the software is no longer the limiting factor so that the hardware can really stand out?
I think just in general, the consumers might just care more about hardware than they care about software at this point. I mean, you essentially have companies catching up with whatever Google is doing on the processing side within a year or two. And the benefits of a software supremacy are not very obvious to the consumer when they make the purchase, Whereas a device that looks beautiful and the device that folds out into a tablet or a device that costs half as much and has the right specs, I think those are much more obvious selling points for most consumers. So I think that's ultimately what's winning here.
Give us a couple of examples from the high end and the low end. You had mentioned the Galaxy Fold. That's an obvious one, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But you just did a video on a company called Realme, which is sort of an offshoot. It was once an offshoot, now it's an independent company from Oppo. And it's grown 800% in the last year based on a bunch of tactics that worked for companies like Xiaomi. But tell us if Realme is a great example of that.
Yeah, I think so. If you look at them, they basically just use Oppo's ColorOS. So they didn't even develop their own software at all. They have told me that they have plans for developing their own software eventually. So maybe next year we'll see that coming. But clearly ColorOS is not the most beloved software skin in the world. I might even say that it's one of the least popular ones out there. And despite that, they've gone from zero to becoming the seventh largest smartphone brand in the world within a year and a half. They've shown incredible growth, and I think it basically all comes down to their phones just being incredibly well made, incredibly aggressively priced, and looking nice, especially for the price. And I think that's really what's driving their success, not really ColorOS, for example.
Interesting. Jerry, what's your thoughts on this idea of hardware beats software? I mean, Martin is in a very different part of the world than North America, right? North American smartphones are no longer subsidized, but they're much easier to obtain for lower costs because they're now financed upfront. So you build the cost of the phone in with your smartphone plan. And, you know, I know that you can do that in Europe, but I believe it's not quite as common. So what are your thoughts about this hardware beats software idea from a North American perspective?
I think it's more of a personal perspective. And I'll explain somewhere on my messy desk. I have an Alcatel flip phone that runs Sailfish, and it does the basic things that I have installed on it way faster than a Galaxy Note 10 Plus does. And it has an ancient Qualcomm MSM application processor, like from the days of the old HTC Hero. That's what it's running. And it's as far as what I expect from it, the software is so well optimized, it's better than arguably the best phone on the market. So that's a example. That's an extreme example. The other end is the Galaxy Note 10 Plus. Look what Samsung had to put in that phone to make it just slightly better than a Pixel 3a. So hardware can beat software. It's not a very cost-effective way to do it, and it depends on what the user wants. Martin was absolutely correct. There are a lot of people who want the best hardware, the best feeling, the best looking, the best running, the fastest. There are a lot of people out there that want that, and this year we saw companies in the West, we know the name Samsung and LG. But also Xiaomi is a great example. Companies that actually will deliver you the very best hardware you can possibly buy. And it's a big step up. Does not create that huge advantage that you would see if you had an ancient laptop running Windows 10 and a new laptop running Windows 10. There would be a gigantic difference between the two. Maybe the gap isn't that big, but it's noticeable, and it's all because they are providing the absolute top of the line hardware. Right now, the way the buyer's market is, I think that that's what people want, and that's what makes Martin's idea correct.
So Martin, at the Qualcomm Tech Summit last week, the company unveiled its flagship Snapdragon 865 platform, as well as a 5G first mid-range 765 and 765G. And we've spoken to sources at companies like Oppo, at companies like Motorola, and they are all admitting that maybe not Motorola, but they're all acknowledging that A, phones are going to get more expensive because the 865 is 5G only. Yeah. But more than that, consumers may have to get used to the fact that their budget flagships, the ones that, you know, these Realme and Redmi devices, the Redmi K20 Pro, for instance, where they're able to put a high-end Snapdragon, the best at the time platform, into a very inexpensive phone without cutting too many corners, that era may be over, and that consumers may just have to suck it up and deal with the fact that those budget flagships are now going to be using 700 series platforms from Qualcomm. Your theory about how hardware beats software, it also comes down to the fact that these companies have figured out ways to maximize margins in other areas so that they can put these really, really powerful high-end platforms into their products. With this sea change of 5G coming, and with this shift towards Qualcomm emphasizing 700 series for those markets, do you think that will change in 2020 and beyond?
With the 7 series and the 8 series chips becoming more expensive, it's I think what is going to happen is we're going to see a lot of phone makers opting not to use the 5G chips. So you're going to have better deals going for cheaper phones with lower end processors. But I also think this is probably a temporary thing, because everything is expensive at first. So maybe this generation, the 5G chips will be significantly more expensive than if they had been 4G chips. But I think in maybe a year or maximum 2 years, most things will just return to normal. I also think that the 5G, like the decision to include 5G, I think it's quite the big gamble from Qualcomm's side. It's a gamble on whether consumers want 5G phones and are willing to pay more for them or not, to which the answer is I think that most consumers are probably ambivalent to it. But it's probably the biggest gamble on them hoping that carriers will really want to push 5G phones over 4G phones, and that they will have increased sales because carriers will be pushing out 5G plans and will be pushing out phones with 5G to go along with those 5G plans. So I think I can't really say how it's going to affect the markets, but my prediction would be that the carriers will be happy and they'll try to push hard on those new phones. And the markets where the carriers aren't very dominant, they're going to be less happy about it.
Martin, you know, one thing the first thing I thought of is Eastern Europe, Brazil, Latin America. MediaTek just got a huge win because of Qualcomm's inevitable price increase. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, but isn't the MediaTek Dimension 1000 or whatever they called, isn't that also 5G only? I don't remember.
I think it is, yeah.
I don't think MediaTek is going to stop making, what is it, the Helios?
The Helio, current MediaTek. Helio G90 and the Dimensity 1000.
Dimensity, yeah, correct.
What a name. I don't think MediaTek has plans to stop making a good, solid 4G processor.
If they manage to put out like a flagship grade or like a processor that competes at least with the 700 series that is 4G and significantly cheaper than whatever Qualcomm puts out, then I'm sure that's going to be a big opportunity for them. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's keep moving. My biggest story of the year was just Huawei. You know, this is a company that, when they debuted the P30 Pro in March, was riding high. They had everything going for them, even though, you know, they weren't allowed to sell products in North America. but they weren't, that wasn't really stopping them. The P30 Pro was by far the best product they'd ever put out. This was a company very, very confident in its trajectory, not really thinking that things would escalate as quickly as they did. Obviously, with a trade war between the US and China looming at the time, there were always tensions. And, you know, today, actually, as of December 13th, as I'm recording this, the trade war is not over, but it's certainly it's getting resolved, or it's in the first stages of a resolution, with China agreeing to drop some of the tariffs and US following suit. We're not sure whether that will free Huawei from the grips of the entity list. But, you know, this idea that all of these non-US companies are subject to such maneuvers by the US, by US companies, that the effects of something like being put on the entity list bar them from doing business with Google, Microsoft, Qualcomm, all of these massive US companies, that can single-handedly, you know, not stop a company from succeeding. But as we saw with ZTE a couple of years ago, it can certainly slow them down significantly. Huawei has not really slowed down, but it now cannot put Google services on its Android phones, which is a big problem for a company that was the fastest growing smartphone vendor in the world for many quarters in a row. Jerry, I'm curious to hear whether you think that the end of this trade war, or at least the potential end of this trade war, could fix things for Huawei, whether they will be removed from the entity list, or whether this is just going to be the norm, the status quo for this massive Chinese company.
It all depends on the way the wind blows, or whatever comic strip, or whatever our president decided to see that morning. He is so unpredictable and destructive, and this is just a mess. Huawei could very well be used as a bargaining chip here. The two things, in case you're not aware, don't have anything to do with each other. The entity list is national security. Somebody somewhere thinks Huawei selling phones in the Verizon store is a national security risk. Therefore, they're not allowed to do business in the U.S. The trade war is, of course, the trade war. If they don't get it resolved, tomorrow everything you buy is 10% more expensive. The two things are separate. But the way our government has worked in the past 3 years, Huawei being a bargaining chip, yeah, I could totally see that happening.
Okay, Martin, in Europe, it's a very different story when it comes to Huawei. We've spoken about this before. This is a brand that sells through in carrier stores. Your country of residence, Germany, just agreed to allow Huawei's network equipment in its 5G network. What is your opinion on Huawei at this time, and what is the broader sort of the broader assessment of Huawei as a security risk from within Western Europe?
So I have a lot of thoughts about Huawei. First, they're still not selling the Mate 30 in Germany, for example. It's somewhere on their website and whatever. But if you go to a store, if you go to a carrier, I've actually tried looking in multiple carrier stores, it's basically not there. They're still pushing the P30. And I think it goes to show that they're actually not comfortable with a phone, even though it's a fantastic phone. In terms of hardware, if it doesn't have the Google services, they're probably not comfortable selling it, which I think is a huge blow to them. And it really puts it in question, like, what happens if the next flagship also doesn't have Google Play services? So I think that the damage there has definitely been done. I've had friends of mine, on an anecdotal basis, I can tell you that I've had friends of mine asking me whether they they were considering buying a Huawei phone, but now they're uncertain. Should they go for it? Should they not? So the damage in terms of reputation and even in terms of sales, I think, has been done here in Europe. Whether they can recover from it, probably. I think people, most people, don't care so much about international relations when they make phone purchases. As long as if the hardware is so much better than the competition, then they would just buy it anyway. But I think the damage has been done, and I don't actually think Huawei will stop their investment into removing American technologies from their supply chain. I think even if they get taken off the entity list, they will continue working to bolster their Huawei services instead of Google services. They'll continue to get rid of every hardware supplier or anything else they're getting from the US as quickly as possible, because they the precedent exists. Now, even if Trump gets eventually voted out of office, if the precedent is there, maybe other governments will also use these tactics. And I think they've become very aware of the damage that could be done to them.
The placement on the entity list has not slowed down the company's profitability, but there are, and as somebody who lived in China, I'd love to hear your perspective on this. From what I understand, Chinese phone buyers are fiercely loyal. I mean, there was a moment in 2014 through 2016 where the iPhone was just exploding in popularity in China, and especially when the iPhone 6 was unveiled in 2014, it really it just propelled Apple to sell millions of units. But since then, the interest in the iPhone, especially since there was a downturn in the Chinese economy, and the price of the iPhone was unobtainable by a lot of people. I'd love to hear your thoughts on, is the success of Huawei in China as much to do with the product itself as patriotism, or is there something else going on? I mean, obviously, Huawei is not the only Chinese, homegrown smartphone brand, but it is the largest and certainly the most vocal. And what do you think? Is that contributing to the success within China itself?
Yeah, I think it's those are the two main factors. I think there's a lot of patriotism. And I think a lot of Chinese people feel that their country as a whole is being attacked by this decision by the U.S. government, and so they see it as a sort of patriotic duty, or rather just they feel like they want to contribute to helping Huawei succeed. They see Huawei as a national champion that they want to become successful. So there's definitely that. But also, Huawei makes fantastic phones, and I also think Huawei actually made the best phones for the Chinese market. They're the ones that fit that market the best. They were the ones who were able to make a really strong flagship portfolio. So up until recently, Oppo, for example, didn't have very strong flagships. They were only really there in the mid-range segment when the Chinese market was transitioning from cheap phones to flagships. So I think Huawei caught that wave very well. And also, in China, there's a lot of, among Chinese people, there's a lot of desire to use the coolest, newest thing. I think even stronger so than in a lot of Western markets. And if Huawei makes the coolest, newest thing, people are very willing to switch over, and if once a brand has established themselves as the leader in a certain area, people are very brand conscious, and they're willing to switch that brand. So I think the combination of those three things is what's really driving their success.
And before we move on, I'd love to hear your theory on where Huawei will go from here. I mean, provided that they are taken off the entity list, or at least given an exemption by the Commerce Department to work with companies like Google again. Is this the Mate 30 Pro was an enormously innovative phone? I mean, there was tons of stuff on there that very few people have gotten to see or use because they just don't have access to the product. You know, is Huawei must be developing products years and years in advance. Do you think that this will slow them down if they are kept on the entity list, or do you think they'll just continue releasing phones in China without Play services and just hope that they can make up the difference in their home market?
I think any company who has to deal with this much pressure is slowed down by it. We've seen examples from different parts of the world with different companies. If the company management is busy doing PR with different journalists to maintain their image, or they're busy doing you know, diplomatic relationships with world leaders around the world instead of focusing on building the newest phones, of course that will hurt their company and their progress. But I also think that Huawei has just become big enough where they can probably continue growing, maybe not as fast as they would have without these restrictions, but I think they will continue growing and dominating.
All right. So we'll move on and talk about Jerry's biggest story of the year. What's your take on Android 10's privacy upgrades?
Well, you gotta tell everybody, I put little air quotes around upgrades.
Upgrades, sorry.
Yeah. Google makes all of their money by collecting our data. I don't think that's a secret to anyone. And when we saw the what's going to be coming in Android 10, and then when we see the Pixel 4, I'm surprised and overjoyed at how much is done on device now instead of in the cloud where Google can profit. It's something I never thought I'd see in Android. At one time, I was very close to ditching Android as a platform over privacy issues. I trust Google with my data that, as far as they're not going to let anyone else see it, I'm just very uncomfortable with the amount I have to give. And to see that amount become less instead of more was utterly, it was shocking. To allow me to shut location permissions off so every random app developer can't track me and sell a database of where I've been to these horrible companies who buy that kind of thing. That's a huge win for all of us. Google Assistant, especially. Assistant needed crowdsourcing to be worth anything at all. And now they're starting to, you know, process a lot of that on device. Then when the Pixel 4 came out, the first thing I did is I made sure it was in airplane mode, and then tried to set up my face for face unlock, and it worked. That means that none of that data really, they didn't lie. None of it's leaving the phone. Those are things that I never would have expected last year, even 2 years ago, but last year especially, that's just not how Google has profited off of Android. And I'm hoping that this is a turning point, and they have, whether they were forced to do these things or maybe they wanted to do them all along, I don't know. I'm just so glad to see it, and it's something that benefits all of us, even if we don't understand it.
I think the fear of regulation and competition is a very healthy one.
Correct.
There's also the whole part about how, you know, Google's ad business is still the primary revenue generator for this near $1 trillion company, right? And at some point, it wants to diversify, and it's trying to do that with hardware. And in order to succeed with hardware, it has to be showing that it's taking privacy seriously. It's a lot easier to obfuscate your privacy indiscretions when it's just all behind the scenes, when you're surfing the internet or when you're doing
right,
when you're using Google services. But when you are using a Nest hub or you are physically holding a Pixel phone, it's a lot more difficult to hide those decisions. And those are all decisions that Google is making. I mean, what's interesting is that, as you said, the Pixel 4 does as much as it can on the device. And Google is framing this as a privacy win for consumers, but it's also just an experience win, right? It's a speed win. If you can do something locally, you don't have to send it up to the cloud for processing and send it back. That's just, it lowers latency. It does all the things that people expect. But yeah, as Martin suggests, Google is just doing what Apple has been doing for many years, but it's doing it a lot better. You know, it's doing on-device transcription. It's doing doing Google Assistant processing on the phone itself.
If you would lay out Xiaomi's latest flagship, an iPhone 11 and a Pixel 4 on a table in front of you, you would say, you can pick them up and you'd be very impressed with everything this Xiaomi phone can do. Maybe you'd be a little bit less impressed with what the Pixel 4 can do. And then there's iOS, which seems very boring. That's because of, there's a lot of data collection going on. Xiaomi knows what its customers want because every time you turn on a Xiaomi phone, that thing you didn't read but you agreed to, you're sending data for everything you do back to Xiaomi. It's mostly innocent data. They're not spying on you, but they are seeing what their customers want by being a little bit intrusive. And the less intrusive you are, the more boring, I hate to use the word boring, but the more boring your software becomes. And I think Google is starting to strike a decent balance there. A Pixel phone is boring when you compare it to a Note 10. Let's be honest. But Samsung also, just knows everything about you because you want to let them know if you want the Note 11 to be just as cool. So I like the balance Google's going for, but mostly I'm so surprised that Google finally is starting to clamp down without being forced to. Although, as Martin alluded to, they probably were going to get forced to if they didn't do it on their own. So here's hoping that they're either forced to or decide to do even more next year.
Well, I mean, the looming antitrust investigation by the Justice Department is probably not helping. The fact that Google is intending to buy Fitbit, and you've written extensively, Jerry, about how under U.S. health privacy laws, Google will not be able to suck up the data from Fitbit devices as it does from your web searches and your phone usage, right? It's protected. And as a result, this is a very interesting but also fraught acquisition. Google probably won't make money from hardware. So how does it intend to use the Fitbit ecosystem to shore up its ad business, if it does at all? Obviously, Google has committed not to putting ads or to using user data to power those ads. But again, like, Google knows what it's doing, and this is a very, very strategic acquisition, and just one in a series of them. So, I think it'll be interesting next year, December 13th, 2020. To revisit this and figure out whether Google was true to its word or whether it had ulterior motives.
Google, you better be true to your word.
We're going to come for you.
I know where you live, Google.
All right, let's move on to best product of the year. Martin, we'll start with you because I let the hate flow through you. I love to hear this. What's your best product of the year?
Yeah, I picked this mostly because I knew it would be controversial, but it's going to be the Galaxy Fold for me. I've only had about 20 minutes to play with it, and I think best product of the year, I mean not necessarily as an end user product, but as a design philosophy or as a form factor, I guess, and as in what it what I hope it will bring for us in the near future. So I played with it. I actually thought it was way more mature feeling than I expected from the hands-on videos and from the images. I thought it was very nice in hand, and I really liked that big screen, even though it is very, very fragile. And given that they've sold apparently 1 million units, although we don't know if that's to end consumers or to their channel partners, but anyway, they probably made at least $1 billion in revenue from that. So I think that means that a lot of other hardware makers will be very interested in making their own foldables. It means that Samsung will be very interested in making a Fold 2. And I hope that in 2 years, when my Note 10 will become annoying and slow, I will be able to switch to a foldable phone as my next daily driver.
When they're under 2,000 euros.
I mean, if they're very good at 2,000 euros, that would also be an option. But I hope they'll be very good and under 2,000 euros, yes.
Jerry, what's yours? Because yours is the complete opposite of the Galaxy Fold in so many ways.
Exactly.
The Pixel 3a XL. And I have to say XL because I've never used the small one. So it could be just as good. That phone is a marvel of engineering at a $500 or less, depending on what day of the week it is or if it's on sale, price tag. It is 90% of a Pixel 4 or an iPhone 11 as far as what you can do with it, and it's 30% of the price. And if you bought a new phone in 2019 and it wasn't a Pixel 3a or 3a XL, you paid too much.
So that's really interesting. I love the Pixel 3a series, and I called it my phone of the year on our site when we were actually I didn't I called it our value phone of the year. My phone of the year was the OnePlus 7T, but there's so much to be said about Google's sort of the two faces of Google's hardware year, right? Like the Pixel 4 was kind of disappointing, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but the 3A was almost universally praised. It was not the typical mid-range experience that you usually get. And it's supported by Google software the same way that its high-end phones are. Plus the fact, you know, I was going to bring this up, Martin, during your discussion of hardware beating software. I think the Pixel 3A series is actually an example of the opposite, where software beats hardware, right? Google has long taken, off the shelf parts and put them together into phones that, for all of their faults, generally perform quite well after some software updates, but generally don't stand out because of their hardware. They manage to eke out the experience from the hardware because of software optimizations and just a commitment to a particular way of using Android. And, you know, I look at the camera of the Pixel 3a as an example. There's really no deficit to speak of going from the Pixel 3 to the 3a. Most people wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And, you know, this is using a Snapdragon 670 chip. The 4 gigs of RAM was not a liability like it was on the Pixel 3. So many things that we disliked about the Pixel 3 did not translate over to the 3A. And I think that's a testament to Google's, yes, its hardware team, which all came from HTC. The 3A was entirely designed by the Taiwan-based former HTC engineering team that Google acqui-hired in 2017. But the 3A, I think, is just a fantastic phone altogether, and especially so in light of the Pixel 4's disappointment. So, yeah, I just found that to be a really interesting contrast.
I was talking more about the flagship side, where I think having the flashiest, newest thing in hardware is more of a selling point than having, you know, very smooth software. But I think on the mid-range side, where phones are more or less all the same, I think software can be a big value add. However, even here, I'm kind of tempted to say that hardware beats software because A, I think the Pixel A, even though it is the most successful Pixel phone ever, still hasn't sold in very large quantities. You look at, for example, the Realme X2 Pro, which costs $399, which is essentially the same price as a Pixel 3a XL or more or less in the same ballpark. And that has a, 50 watt Super VOOC charging and a Snapdragon 855 Plus and a 90 hertz screen and the God knows what. I'm still not entirely convinced that that is winning in all respects.
I get your point. And I get your point. I won't belabor the subject because we got to move on. I changed my best product of the year in mid-cycle. I was going to say that it was the Huawei P30 Pro. And I used that phone from the time that it was released all the way through the end of the summer. And basically until I got my OnePlus 7T. And then, I switched it up. But the P30 Pro is and what was and is an engineering marvel. It does a lot of things right. But I really just want to take a moment to praise OnePlus for the leaps and bounds improvements in so many areas this year. No, it doesn't have a perfect camera. No, it still doesn't have official waterproofing and wireless charging. Those are semantics. Those are very small things, in my opinion. I think overall, this year saw OnePlus do a number of things. It's extremely confident in the products that releases, more so than ever. It's taking certain things seriously that it didn't take before. Software updates in particular are just so much better than they were during the OnePlus 3 and 5 days. The quality of OnePlus's software has improved so much. And the OnePlus 7T, in my opinion, feels like a complete thought from the battery to the performance to the software to the camera. To the haptics, to basically everything that matters to me on a product. Yes, there was the security incident a few weeks ago. We still don't have full details there, but OnePlus is over the days of sticking its foot in its mouth. It no longer makes the same stupid publicity mistakes that it used to. It just feels like a company that is making inroads in places that it needs to. In the US carrier market in particular, it's doing quite well. We just saw the release of the OnePlus 7T 5G McLaren Edition. Sorry, OnePlus 7T Pro 5G McLaren Edition on T-Mobile, which is a terrible name, but a beautiful phone. And, it's a $900 phone. And a lot of people would say, well, how dare OnePlus release a $900 phone? But the fact that it can release a $900 phone and still get away with talking as confidently as it is just a testament to how far the brand has come. It doesn't need to rest on the idea that it's making cheap phones. It now can make good phones that happen to be cheaper than everybody else. So, I love the OnePlus 7 Pro. I thought it was a bit big and a bit cumbersome, but the OnePlus 7 series in general, I think, was my product of the year.
I think it's amazing how OnePlus was able to, over the past 2, maybe 3 years, slowly creep out of that mid-range price and start to sell $700, $800, $900 phones, yet people still think of them as a great value phone company. I don't know how they did it, but it's amazing.
It is. It's smart, right? Increasing your product's price by $30 every year will eventually get you to the point where you are no longer in the cheap range, and the OnePlus 7 Pro is not a cheap phone, but compared to so many other high-end $1,000 products on the market, it's cheap. It's cheaper, and that's enough.
Also, Dez, if you're listening, Dez from T-Mobile, I really want one of those McLaren phones. So
yeah, Dez, send Jerry a McLaren and put the phone inside the car.
That's even better, yes.
So we'll move on to our last segment, which is the biggest disappointment of the year. Martin, I'll start with you because This one is also a bit of a doozy.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. I think we've already talked about this, so maybe it's not that exciting. But I was most disappointed by how the U.S. government handled this whole Huawei fiasco. Actually, they created the fiasco. And I just thought that this was – it was such a self-inflicted wound from the U.S. government side. They've essentially said that that Huawei is a security issue, and then we can't supply them with whatever components and technology, but then they still supply them. I think they've lost a lot of they've both lost a lot of face, and became very — their part of the story became very hard to believe. But then it also made Huawei very aware that they have to replace all the U.S. technologies in their supply chain and all other Chinese companies as well. They made the Chinese government very aware that they have to do to bolster up their chip manufacturing and to find alternatives to U.S. Suppliers. And I think on the long term, this will be a terrible loss for the U.S. government and the U.S. economy in a whole.
Amen.
Let's follow the — we didn't talk about this in the earlier segment, but I want to follow this through to its potential logical conclusion. So the trade war gets resolved, but the U.S. says, we still don't trust Huawei. We still don't want them doing business with U.S. companies. So we're going to keep them on the entity list, and we're not going to let Google provide Android licenses to Huawei. In a year, in 2 years, once Huawei has inevitably started selling again in the West, but is now free of all Google services, it has the Huawei app store, whatever it's called. They've done these deals with developers to get those apps on the app gallery. What do you think that perception will be? Do you think Huawei will actually be in a position of strength if it does not have Google services? Can it replace them with others and still get away with it?
I think there's some things that they can't replace. So, for example, one of the most interesting stories for me from this whole Huawei mess is that I heard from Brian Ma, the analyst from IDC, that actually Huawei managed to become the number two seller of PCs in China before the whole mess started, which is just amazing in the first place because they have like two laptops or something. And they fell from the number two spot to the number seven spot within less than half a year. I don't even know who the other seven would be beyond HP and Dell and Lenovo and Asus. But it basically means that without a Windows license, their entire PC business collapsed. And I don't know how they could sell. I mean, they could create their own desktop OS, but that's just too many things to do at once. They could use Linux, but I mean, that's a hard ask. So there are some parts of their business where I don't think they can do anything without being able to have business relationships with US companies. However, I think in terms of phones, they might move away eventually. And I don't think, in the coming years, they'll become a big player in the US smartphone market. But I think around the rest of the world, around Asia, around Europe, around South America, they could become very dominant, and that might be a big enough market for them.
All right. Jerry, what is your biggest disappointment of 2019?
The Galaxy Fold. it, from a practical engineering standpoint, that is an abomination. It should have never left a laboratory in South Korea. My biggest kick is that there is no back bevel on the underlying support layer on the display, so you have to see a crease when it's open. That's such an easy thing to fix, and it wasn't fixed. The whole fiasco with the hinge, or the screen protector that wasn't really a screen protector and is an actual structural layer of the phone that they didn't tell anybody about. That phone, especially the first iteration, was a nightmare beyond the Note 7 fiasco. I think Samsung did an excellent job with the Note 7. The Galaxy Fold, that should have just Samsung should have to pay everyone on the earth $10 just because they had the audacity to release that the way it was.
So you're saying that a phone that hurt nobody and didn't actually go on sale and was recalled and replaced before anybody other than reviewers got a hold of it was a worse thing than phones that exploded and actually hurt people?
No, I said the way the company handled it.
But they did handle it. They didn't release the phone. They just went back to the drawing board and fixed the problems.
No, they didn't fix the problems.
Oh.
The phones are still breaking. They have to provide you with one free screen replacement. It is a fragile piece of crap. I'm sorry. I'll be harsh. And it is a beautiful piece of crap. And parts of it are a marvelous piece of crap. Martin hit one point exactly. When you open it up, especially from the back, it feels so solid. It feels like it's one piece until you get to the front side where it's just a mess. I would expect this from some company I have never heard of from the East, but I would not expect this from Samsung.
I think we have our podcast title, A Beautiful Piece of Crap.
There we go.
Well, I mean, Jerry, you know that Huawei or you know that Samsung is already in the, you know, well into its R&D and development of second gen foldables.
And we know that. I'm very glad they are because the first Galaxy Note was a huge piece of crap.
Right. But here's the thing today. Right? You have to release something before it gets improved on, right?
Right. But I can still be very disappointed at it.
Okay.
About it.
Fair enough. I do think there's a reason other than the fact that Huawei has been hamstrung by the entity list. I do think there's a reason nobody can buy the Mate X yet. And they probably wanted to see exactly what would happen with Samsung's re-release of the Fold. A million units, though, is actually quite impressive. And it's something, you know, in Canada, the phone went on sale on December 6th. So it was a lot later than in other parts of the world. And the company has sold out of them twice. So,
okay.
It's a $2,700 phone here. So that's not cheap.
The million units. The original Pixel sold a million units in the first week from Verizon alone. The original Pixel was a flop of monstrous proportions when you come down to sales. A million units is nothing.
But a million units of a $2,000 phone is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think it is. If you look at revenues, it basically means that if you count with $2,000, that would be a theoretical maximum of $2 billion of revenue for 3 months of sales of a phone. They obviously didn't make all $2 billion, but even if they made, I don't know, $1.5 billion, they made more money from just the Fold alone than Microsoft made from all of Surface in a quarter. So I wouldn't call that an absolute flop. I think it's a first generation rough device that proves that there is a market for foldables, but this one isn't it yet. That's how I'd put it.
Oh, we're so, in agreement mostly.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it is simultaneously a huge disappointment and a fantastic achievement.
Exactly.
It can be, and I think it needs to simultaneously be so that we can get to Gen 2 and 3 and so on.
I actually like what LG is doing and what Microsoft says they're going to do. Who knows if that product will ever really see the light of day. Bezels belong on phones for a reason, structural reasons. You do what you can do to either include the bezel or minimize the bezel and have two separate screens that you can sync together through software is a great way to handle this problem.
That's true. It's interesting that, a company like Motorola is saying, you know, we spent 5 years working on the Razr and we're still going to be very cautious about how we release it. I think next year or in a couple of years, every phone maker will have a foldable that is a traditional foldable, and they'll be much cheaper, but the quality will be just across the board, right? We'll get crappy Royal FlexPi like hardware, and then we'll get really great hardware at completely, you know, opposite price points. And that's okay, because I think that's exactly what we need in this industry. So I'm gonna finish this off by talking about my disappointment of the year, and that would be 5G. Now, I think this was an inevitability. I think somebody had to bring up the fact that 5G. I think this is a similar story to the Fold, right? 5G was all promise and very, very little delivery. I think 5G it's launched, it's sputtered out of the gate, it's gone backwards, it went back to the gate a couple of times as, you know, they figured out their stuff. But ultimately, 5G is out there. You can go to any U.S. carrier right now. You can go to carriers in parts of Europe, in the UK, in Korea, in China, and you can get a 5G phone. The networks are there, but the promise has not really delivered, and especially in North America, it has not delivered. Part of the Qualcomm Tech Summit was the fact that they had 5G nodes installed at the resort that we were staying at, that you could use your Verizon Note 10 Plus and access 2 gigabit speeds on the beach. They made a, you know, huge noise about that. But if you went into a shadow or you hid behind a tree, you lost that signal, right? That's millimeter wave. You get all this publicity around how T-Mobile is just blanching the country with 5G, but it's at 600 megahertz. It's using 10 or 20 megahertz of spectrum in most places. You're not getting speeds above 150 megabits, and it's just not interesting. It's the story will become interesting when the use cases arrive, but right now it is a solution in search of a problem. But even the solution is half-hearted at best. And then there's this whole waiting game around T-Mobile and Sprint, whether the merger will go through and when, not if, when it goes through, that will be an enormous sea change for the U.S. mobile industry. So that will give T-Mobile, or the new T-Mobile, 2.5 gigahertz spectrum that they will use to basically launch the only, quote, good type of 5G for the next couple of years, until we figure out how millimeter wave can be successfully integrated into urban areas. And then there are places like Canada, where I live, where 5G is not even being talked about. It's completely fluff. We still haven't had a 600 megahertz auction. We still haven't had a millimeter wave auction. And yet the carriers cannot help but fall over themselves talking about how amazing 5G will be and the promise of it. So that is my biggest disappointment of the year. I'm not bitter because I don't have 5G. I'm happy that at least by the time 5G launches in Canada, it'll be a mature standalone technology. But it also means that anybody who's an early adopter is going to feel the pain. So I'd like to close on that. Martin, what's your quick take on how 5G is rolling out in Europe? And do you share my opinion?
I don't really have a hot take other than I share your opinion. And it's very, uncertain. The rollout is slow and not well done.
Jerry, what about you?
I think it's going to be 10 years before we see real 5G that works in North America, because of just how big the U.S. and Canada are, the way the technology works, and regulatory bodies. Some of the richest people in this country live in an area where they can't get LTE because nobody's allowed to put a tower up. That's how the United States works, folks. You know, your senator, there's a very good chance he lives in a town in Virginia that does not have LTE for his Verizon phone. So those are hurdles that have to be overcome somehow.
And eventually they may be overcome, and maybe they won't.
We'll Space Force, baby. Space Force.
Satellites, bring them back. All right. So I was going to ask what your predictions for 2020 are going to be, but I don't think we have time for that. So we'll just have to have you back on, Martin, for a 2020 appreciation podcast. What do you say?
All right. Let's do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'd love to learn a bit more about what you're up to, because you have a couple of pots in the fire. You're doing your Tech Alter channel on YouTube, but you also have something new going on. Tell us about Nebula.
Yeah, I have multiple new things going on. Tech Alter is going on as normal. Then we have a new video streaming service called Nebula. I am part of a network called Standard, which has about 100 YouTube creators. They're all like educational type creators. So you have channels like Real Engineering, like Kurzgesagt, like CGP Grey, like Tierzoo, and many others. And we have launched our own video streaming service. So basically the idea is that the platform is owned by Standard and by us, the creators. It's built by us. And we put all of our videos there. It's a paywall thing, so I think it's about $3 a month, but you can get it for free if you have a CuriosityStream subscription from one of our sponsored links. And we do original videos there. I haven't done an original yet, but there are about, I think, two or three originals coming out every month, in entire series and entire like documentary length things. The concept is to give creators a kind of playground where we can try out a lot of things that would otherwise not be very easy to do on YouTube. So my content is about as advertiser friendly as it gets. So I'm not too afraid of, I don't know, COPPA and about demonetization and whatever harassing regulations there are on YouTube. But basically, a lot of our channels do history-focused stuff or like engineering stuff that might talk about war-related topics, or we have a lot of creators who talk about, they do sex-related topics or gender-related topics and so on. And it's basically a place for all of us, and especially for them, to have a way to create videos that would otherwise be a little difficult to do on YouTube. And it's ad-free, so you don't have to worry about being spammed with stuff. Most of our videos, including mine, they come out a few days before they release on YouTube. That's basically Nebula. And then I'm also doing an app that I think I was talking about the last time I was on this podcast. So I'm building a product review app. It's basically like a user-generated product review app, kind of like how you have a Yelp for restaurants and you have like, I don't know, TripAdvisor for hotels and whatever. We want to do a separate app for users to rate and review gadgets. So we're starting with gadgets specifically, with smartphones, with earphones, with laptops and consoles and stuff, because that's my audience. And we're using the Tech Outdoor audience as the initial testers. But we're eventually planning to open up to other kinds of products as well. And that's in a closed beta right now. You can go to crowd.com. That's crowd with two R's. And you can sign up for the beta if you want.
So we'll have all of those links in our show notes if you want to check out Nebula. And what was the name of the app again? Sorry.
Crowd. It's Crowd with two R's.
Oh, it's actually called Crowd. Sorry, I thought that was like the crowdsourcing platform.
That's we called it Crowd because it's basically crowdsourced reviews. So it's
That's awesome. Two R's. I'm going to sign up for the beta, so you have to approve me, okay?
Okay.
Me too, just so I can complain about NVIDIA RTX.
Okay, we can do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Martin. It's been a pleasure having you. And Happy New Year.
Thank you for having me, and happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays, happy New Year, and all that. And Jerry, as always, thank you so much. It's always good having you on the show.
Oh, tell me sweet little lies, baby.
You can sing to me anytime. All right,
it's great to be here.
We may have a show next week, but that'll probably be our last show of the year. Let us know what you think about the show at podcast@androidcentral.com. We love hearing from you. Your homework for this week: what is your favorite product of 2019? What did you love this year? Tell us. We love getting your email. My name is Daniel Bader. You can find us all at androidcentral.com. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.